Hello and welcome to yet another episode of ANK's Wheel of Time podcast, where we're going through a chapter-by-chapter review of the books. And today we're doing Book 1, Chapter 18, The Camelin Road. Or Camelin Road, sorry. And quite a lot does happen in this one. It's going to be a... To say eventful would be...
Fun.
It's not just another one of those, walking down the street kind of things. So a lot does actually happen in this chapter. I mean, we start off with a basic description that it's a main road of sorts. They've been travelling, they've left Baelon, it appears to be, 2 days now? That they've been travelling and living on bread and cheese.
Yeah.
I don't mind cheese sandwiches, but I would agree with Egwene that, it would...
After a while, you don't want to eat if you've been eating it for a while.
Yeah. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner, cheese sandwich, cheese sandwich, cheese sandwich
It's almost like if someone was eating bread all the time, it's like, you just give me a good juicy steak.
Yeah.
Which I don't understand, because they've got like a ward there, so surely they can hunt for a rabbit or something.
Yeah, it's
but
not...
But then they've got to eat that and they've got to cook it.
I'm not going to eat raw rabbit there. That's just a bit much.
I'm just saying.
And, they did... Because you've got the Aes Sedai and... you've got Moraine and Nynaeve. Not Moraine. Ugh. Let's get the names right. We got Egwene and Nynaeve, the wisdom, both kind of fantasizing, I'd like to just have some tea or something, and Len kind of spanks him a little bit, saying, no, fire, bad.
But they knew that. They were just, they were daydreaming, I wish we could have it. But understanding and knowing the reasons why not, it was just a daydream. Anyway.
So the question does get asked, why are we following the road when we could be cutting, cross country in a more kind of direct road to Whitebridge, where we're trying to go. And there are some really good strategic kind of reasons, for this. One is it's harder going across, going cross country rather than along the road, and so they would make less time. But there's also no guarantee that that Whitebridge is going to be a safe place to go to, because the Trollocs or the Fades may have left a guard up there of sorts. I mean, kind of knowing where they were
heading. Well, it's more a case of they knew they were heading that way because there was no other way to cross the river. Except on that bridge, because there were no ferries or anything like that anywhere else along that thing. They kind of almost set themselves into set themselves up into their own little trap, I guess, in a way. Because if, when you look at the little map that you're given at the front of the book, there is literally no other way to go except that way. I mean, there is up, I get it, but there's river. Pretty much cutting across the entire thing. It's almost like Berlon's its own little river island, as it were.
Coastal area of sorts.
No, it's not a coastal. Well, it's just in the middle, but it's
from
literally
a river,
cut off.
From a river coast kind of thing. I'm not talking coast of the whole thing.
It's almost like a encircled around with rivers on all sides, or in a lake on the other. So there's no way to get out of it. Unless by a boat.
Now I'm going to throw in a bit of a Stargate reference at this point, just because, I can.
it wouldn't be an episode without you throwing in some Star Trek reference.
Stargate in this game, not Star Trek.
Star Trek and...
Well, there's that, but... The Trollocs and the Fades seem to be using a similar kind of method that... gets used a few times and that the Jaffa use in Stargate in trying to track them down in terms of setting up a kind of triangle or kind of having a host ahead of them, a host behind them, kind of blowing a horn to each other so they can hear, okay, we're here, we're here, there's somewhere in the middle. And slowly closing the gap between the two.
Forcing them to go no other way but the way that they want. Yeah, but that's strategic. That's strategic in any book or strategy.
I know, but I want to throw a Stargate reference in there.
Oh my goodness. I mean, seriously, you could throw any reference in there.
I know.
That references that form of thing from any TV show or...
Not to mention ancient history as well. Yes. I'm quite sure that there were maybe the Romans might have done similar things or something. I don't know, but anyway.
They were very rigid, although it doesn't surprise me that they were quite strategic as well.
Yeah. I could go down that road a bit, but we got a lot to talk about in this chapter. It's going to take a while anyway. Anyway, they move, it's initially, you know, based on this, the sound of the horns, Ren makes, an initial determination that they're no more than 10 miles away, which overall is not that far. You've got, during this time as well, Lan tells Moraine to, you know, to keep them moving, while Lan actually goes to do some scouting to see, you know...
Reconnaissance.
Yeah.
To make sure, and see how far away they are and what they're doing.
And what they're actually facing.
And she leads them in a trot, and they're like, what? Why aren't we running forward? And it does make sense that, obviously, if they're herding them into a particular direction... that they clearly are wanting them to go in that direction to lay a trap. And so she's keeping her head quite impressively. And I'm kind of impressed with them as well, because they do actually listen and they don't, you know, run off in a huff or a, you know, skitter of nerves. They actually manage to do that quite well.
Yeah.
Even though they get closer and closer.
And Moraine, I think, is doing... she's doing the only thing that she really can, because she does make a very valid point here that they are wanting us to go in this direction, and we don't know what's in that direction waiting for us, and you want us to go running headlong into it?
Into it, yeah.
That's intelligent. So let's just go a little keep slower so that we can keep our options as open as...
possible.
As possible, which granted, few and far between at this point, in terms of what those options may be. But Lan comes back and starts to give a bit of a report. And yeah, having 500 Trollocs on your ass, less than an hour away.
She does make another point as to why do they let us know where they are? Perhaps so that we will hurry into something that without thinking.
Yeah.
And it is a very valid point. And then, of course, they get news about their situation.
And so I would, at this point, hearing that, I'd be really going a little bit of, oh, crap. And... he does ask a question, and this is, you know, Rand asking it, being that if they had that, oh no, not Rand, this is Moraine, kind of saying if they had that many before, why
were they used?
Yeah, and if they didn't, why?
Where'd they come from?
Yeah.
How'd they manage to cross without detection?
And that is leading me to, that kind
there
of a question.
There has to be some sort of an underground tunnel system that they've built.
Or at least some kind of secure location that they've been, that there's been a secret build-up of troops.
But still, they would have noticed it if it was above ground.
Not necessarily. It depends where it was, and it's and looking at the scale of the map at the beginning of the book, and the fact that they've only covered at least in the part that we've been reading, such a small area.
Yeah.
There's still plenty of country where this could have been. And we don't know clearly yet how the One Power works, but, and now I'm going to throw in a Hobbit reference. But there may have been some kind of cloaking magic.
Maybe.
They could have...
The dark ones cloaked them, but they'd be actually be able to feel the dark.
Not necessarily.
Powers. Well, no, because they seem to be given... You seem to be given the impression that you can feel the dark... You can feel dark magic being used.
When you're close to it, sure. If she or another Aes Sedai of her equivalent power... Because I'm guessing that there's different skill levels... For users...
I still like my idea of an underground sort of...
It's possible.
...camping area or tunnels.
I'm not disputing that as being an option. I'm just
like
that...
with The Hobbit, how they went under the ground with the big giant worms and then they came out that way.
Yeah.
They travelled underground.
Not to mention the fact that orcs in there don't like the light.
Yes.
Similar deal, they don't
like the light.
Yeah, it does make sense. I'm just saying that there are options in terms of how this could have happened.
I like my option better.
And so it seems to me that either Moraine's been out of contact with Tar Valon for too long and hasn't been able to keep up with the
latest news. Yeah, but no,
latest intelligence.
They go to taverns and stuff enough to.
Yeah, but that's just for local. News. Yeah, well, that's just local gossip.
Not all the time. Because other cities, city to city, people communicate and traders travel from local city to gossip. City. Traders travel from city to city and they bring that city's news from when they were there.
It's not the same as a true intelligence network.
Fair enough. But you don't, in this sort of, unless you have telephones and stuff, you're not going to get true intelligence for a while yet.
Hmm.
Given the time frame or
I know, but that's also
there's no telephones. It's all horse and cart still.
No, we don't know how the Aes Sedai communicate. There may be telepathy.
For crying out loud.
Pigeons? Carrier pigeons?
And you're assuming then that every Aes Sedai has access to magic? Or trains in it?
Carrier pigeon?
Oh my goodness. Although that would be rather cool. Because I've always liked the whole Brody sending the message thing.
Yeah, I know. That's one thing which I love about the John Wick movies too, is the fact that even in this day and age, that
the little birds would be used.
He will always be Morpheus to me. But Lawrence Fishburne's kind of thing. I've forgotten what he called himself, but he was actually deleted the Homeless Assassins, I suppose. But he his method of communication was by carrier pigeon. Anyway, moving on. So they realise now that there's a group in front of them, a group behind them. So the only way
they're kind of encircled.
The only way they can go is either north or south. Mm.
South leads them away.
Yep. Leads to the hills of Abshire, barren and dead, and the Tarn with no way to cross and no traffic by boat. And to the north, we can reach Arunel by nightfall. And they may be able to cross the river.
That's where they know that they're going to be going, so there's a higher chance of a trap there. And they know that riding into it. Which I was rather surprised at, because this is the part where it really surprised me that they actually went for it. They started riding along to it, and they went for it. They attacked. I was dumbstruck because they actually didn't hesitate this time in going in. I suppose they had enough training to sort of feel confident enough without hesitation, but it was still a surprise because they've only really been together for, a week or so at this point. And you don't really get that much out of, what, we've been generous, 2 weeks?
Roughly. Maybe I'd say around 2 to 3 at this point, would be where we're at since they've left Evans Field. They have been pretty much constantly on the go. They've been able to have maybe 1 or 2 days kind of respite, but that's
But the training's not really being mentioned too much. Mm. And even then, it's not going to be... I'd say two, because it's not going to be that much in the way of... There's not much you can get. I mean, really, sword play is something that you... that requires constant practice.
Yes.
Much like anything else. And the only way they're going to get better at sword play is... fighting is...
That's one thing which I loved, which I did love about the Aragorn the books. I'll stress the books, the movie, and we've already talked about that, and we'll never raise that again. But from the books, I love the fact that every night, Brom and Aragorn would train.
Yes.
You know, that they would spend... they'd make sure that every day... initially, every
night before they went down...
With sticks, and then with magically protected swords so they wouldn't hurt themselves too much. Because even though he was going to be a dragon rider, and sure, he would have Saphira to be a formidable weapon in and of herself.
He needed to be able to defend himself.
Yes.
For her. Yeah. And then later on, when Brom passes, he gets help.
Yeah, he continues training every night. Yep, and he maintains that.
Yeah.
And sadly, because they've always had to be on the go, they these guys haven't really had that same opportunity.
Mm.
They've always
always had to be riding. They've not been able to stop, which is why I'm saying there's not a lot of training, and yet they're. I'm surprised at the fact that they're going for it.
Now there's a line
they've kind of got no choice, I suppose, but still. They're going for it.
There's a line here which I am very curious about, and I'm wondering if it's the same place that gets referenced at the end, but we'll get to the end of the chapter when we get there, but the fact that there is a place that Trollocs will not go. And Moraine Lan makes a comment, and Moraine is extremely resistant to that idea. She doesn't want to go there. For some reason, and which is really getting me curious as to what kind of a place do both the good, proverbial good guys...
And Trollocs not
want to go. And Trollocs not want to go. What place is freaking everyone out so much?
It can't be where the dragon made a himself.
No, the Trollocs would be happy to go there.
Maybe, unless, of course, the mountain somehow swallows them via myth or something we haven't heard about.
Oh, possibly, but... I don't know. It's that kind of thing has got me curious.
It's more a case of the fact that the Trollocs actually fear something.
Well, the fact that they fear something isn't overly surprising. Everyone has got... everyone fears something. For one, close to the edge of a cliff.
because they've actually mentioned that Trollocs, if they fear you, they will hesitate, but they won't hesitate for too long. You know, they won't. They will eventually attack because it's in their nature.
Yeah.
But they will hesitate. So even if they fear, they will hesitate. But there's not very much in the way of
things
that scare them.
I know, I'm not disputing. I'm just saying that everyone has got a fear weakness of some form.
Yes, but I'm
for just one, let's not
less
than the amount of times you've bitten me black and blue over a spider the size of my fingernail is actually kind of funny.
Spiders live outside, not in my house.
Uh huh. Anyway, so they make a decision to of those two choices to go north, and the horns are continuing to kind of gauge each other, you know, where they are, and they are slowly getting slowly getting closer.
They're within an hour.
Yep, and then
this event happens.
And they are starting to move, Lan is setting a hard pace, and they started moving a bit faster, and with the latest one, they're now down to 2 miles, so they are moving, this group of Trollocs is moving pretty fast to get there.
But they're also moving fast because they know that there is a trap ahead, and they figure, okay, the best way to do it is to surprise them, I suppose, like a surprise sort of, we're here, and then they're on them kind of thing. It's very fast for how it happens. before they, you know, they get it, because it's almost like, you know, they get over the hill, they reach the top of, and then they, that's it, they're in, and they're attacking.
Well, they realize that the fake. There's an fake. Well, we'll get to that. One quick comment, then you can say what you want to do. And that my one quick comment is that they're running into to the first group of scouts. At this point, and they're realizing, okay, we're in trouble.
They're not running into the first group of scouts. They're running into the trap.
There are Trollocs nearby. Some of the scouts sent ahead of the rest.
With the Fade.
Yeah. The Fade's not mentioned there yet. Really?
They attack. The Fade's slightly startled, but hesitates just a little, but does actually go in to fight. And I like that part, that he hesitates. It's like, oh, crap, they're here. Oh, right, okay, I have to fight now. it's kind of comical.
A little bit, if you look at it that way. But because I'm having a really cool, if they were to turn this into a movie, and quite frankly, personally, I think TV series would be better for this given how long it is. I mean, 13 or 15 books or something like that would be an awesome TV series, and they'd be able to get a lot of milk out of this, I think. But anyway, I'm having a really cool image of our line of heroes, or a group of heroes kind of walking up, kind of going up the hill. And as they're topping the top of the hill, they see down the bottom, army.
Uh-huh. Except this is not an army. This Small is just one. A couple. I know. Come on. It's not going to be that impressive. And it's more a case of that they're running on a horse. They're riding
the
on
line horse stretched horses. Far to either side. The ends out of sight. At its center, directly in front of Land of Fade Road. That's an army. Small one, I'll grant, but it's an army.
It's a circle of
it's trolleys. A line, not a circle.
Fair enough. They still fight.
Yes, they do, because they've got no other choice. Yes, they do. They got no other choice at this point. And there are, all of them have their own kind of war cry.
Yeah.
So we got three war cries for the Seven Towers, Manetherin, and Karai El Caldazar, Karai and Elisande, El Elisande.
Impressive enough. I'm glad you said it, not me.
And the Fae sees all these people coming towards him, and he's like, huh?
I think he was just more surprised about the fact that they weren't hesitating, they weren't fearful. Like, he was expecting them to be, like, in the bar or the inn, you know. He froze, he didn't do anything, and I think he was expecting the same sort of response, and so, yeah, was a bit startled.
Hmm.
Seeing them. But, you know, Land was running right for him, and so was Moraine, so...
And they all charge in, and now we've got ourselves a full-on combat set. The first, feel free to correct me, but this will be the first actually full-on battle kind of thing, and right now...
Well, at least the one that we get to read about.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, well, obviously that was
the heroes are involved in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm kind of... The image that I'm having here is... At least the related image. It's kind of like the scene at the end of the Fellowship where Aragorn and Gimli and Legolas are kind of taking on the orcs as Frodo's trying to run away.
And Merry and Pippin happen to...
Yeah, well, essentially that bit there is... is kind of the closest analogy I can kind of picture to what's actually happening here.
At the moment, yeah.
And so they're all in this combat situation. They're all kind of taking on this this group, and it's not until, and they do pretty well holding their own for people who are only rudimental whatever, that word, trained, very rudimentary, trained, with swords and their other weapons. They're doing pretty well to hold their own.
I think, and I find that quite impressive, and that's where I kind of think it's slightly unrealistic in some ways, because, you know, like I said, it's only been at maximum 2 weeks training.
Well, and maybe three. I'd stress it to three.
And not every, that's why I'm saying two, and not every night was spent rigorously practicing these moves.
Mm.
At least not from what we can gather, because they pretty much read, like, you know, they have a bath, they go to sleep, you know.
Yeah.
And whenever
they're listen to Tom's stories for a bit.
Yeah, whenever they've, you know, rested, or there's been a slow down period, it's not been, oh yes, let's get out our swords and train. It's, you know, oh, look at this and look at that, and let's go wandering around and stuff. So, I don't know, Trollocs to me seemed to be given a little more training, or a little more sort of fighty, I guess.
Yeah.
So for them to hold their own in them is quite impressive, and I kind of think it's slightly unrealistic as well. I think at this point it's kind of pure dumb luck. I think they're more as a case of maybe they're stunned about the fact that these people are actually fighting them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of getting over the surprise, and that's the only thing I can think that in my own mind to rationally see how all of a sudden they were able to hold their own against a Trolloc. The only other explanation I have is that in part some of their old lives are kind of, or their previous old selves, previous experience is kind
going
of
down the road of reincarnation here.
Reincarnation, yeah. Or that their old sort of selves within them are kind of guiding them and helping them to know what move to make.
Maybe.
Out of unconscious thought.
I'm finding that you know, the weapons that the Trollocs are using you know, to be interesting as well, because while I'm sure some of them are using some, you know, pretty sharp objects, they've also got these sticks with hooks, with little noose things on them, which is generally the kind of thing that's used to capture people,
yeah.
Or to capture you know, or to capture horses, or, you know, to capture animals or whatever. It's a capturing capturing device. It's not a killing device.
I don't know. Have you ever seen a fisher's hook thing? Those big. I was imagining those big harpoon sort of fishing hooks.
No, it says it.
But that's what I, you know.
Well, I'm sure that they may very well have some of those too.
I was imagining it. I was imagining it as, because it's saying a hook, right? And I was imagining it as a harpoon sort of shape, sharp hook type thing, like a lethal thing.
Yeah, well, I'm not just hearing that. There were some of those things there too, but, you know, a noose on the end of the pole swept at Rand's head. They were trying to capture him. Either that, or it's actually, or the noose bit has actually got a extra string on the end of it that can be pulled to kind of strangle someone, maybe.
Maybe. Or, well, they did say that they wanted to talk, so it could be a form of catching. But either way, you can strangle to death, or be strangled to death, or your neck can be broken.
Yeah.
They could be quite forceful in their yanking, to the point where they're able to use it lethally to snap a person's neck.
Mm. They tried, they did try to get Rand out of his saddle. Gave a good try at it, failed. He managed to keep his seat. Well done, Rand, I do have to admit. Took a lot of effort on his part to be able to do that. Managed to hack up a couple of Trollocs and whatnot. And then his Lan finally does get the, you know, manage to kill off, or at least slow down the fade.
Well, it's more a case of that all of, he wasn't focused on that at the time. He was focused on keeping himself alive, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh wait, Egwene's in here and she doesn't know how to fend for herself.
Oh, there's that concern as well.
So then he's looked around for her, which I think is It's realistic, but it's also a really, you know, you're in a fighting situation. There's swords and stuff coming after your heads, and you're going to look around for a Gwaint.
Like, why not? He's got to make sure that his people are okay.
Yeah, well, fair enough.
Not to mention the girl.
Yeah, of his dreams, I get it. But it's more a case of, you know, someone's trying to kill him or capture him, and he's worried about another person. And I get the whole thing, but it's more a case of when you worry about, how many times has it been the case where they worry about someone else, they're distracted, and they get caught or killed as a result, you know?
So they manage to get away from this one. They see the Murdrel headless.
First of all the Chollocks all of a sudden start screaming their heads off, and he's wondering why until he turns around and sees the Fade headless. So they're all screaming, so which makes me curious as to whether or not they're all somehow interconnected or under his control. So it's almost maybe like the Fade has some sort of a control or hold over them, almost like these Chollocks have no choice but to be who they are because they are spellbound in some way to a Fade and to listen to his commands and do it.
So I get a reference yet again. Hello, Goa'uld. How you doing?
No, well, that's more individualized. This is on group mass.
Really?
It's more individualized. Okay, well, how many times has the Gould attacked another Gould? And, you know, that's not... This is different. This is... Well, they all do what the Fade says. They don't get to attack each other. They don't get to rise up and be the new ruler.
All right, fine. I'm just... All I'm saying, that as far as this is concerned, you've got, the Jafar who are enthralled to the... initially at the start of the series, and I know it changes later on, who are enthralled to their Gould masters. And it's not until they start to see some of them die.
Well, they're enslaved a little.
And it's not until they see some of them die that some of them start to question it, and they start to have their own doubts for the most part. I know there are a couple of exceptions.
That's religious. That's sort of slightly religious type thing. This not religion. They're connected psychically somehow.
Magically.
Or magically. But it's in a psychic way, because he gets his head torn and chopped off and they're all screaming their heads off. So clearly they feel his pain or the loss of his connection to them, and now they're like, okay.
Ah, better reference.
Okay. Here we go again.
Well, let's just go Star Trek, DS9, the whole Dominion thing.
We finally got around to Star Trek.
Yeah, we did. In this case, it's, you know, when the Vorta dies and the Jem'Hadar no longer have access to the Ketracel White that they need to live on, and they start to lose their minds a little bit.
I can see a drug. I can see the loss of a drug.
Yeah.
In reference, so I can see that. I'll pay that one, but not the others.
Anyway, moving on. So we've got, it turns out that only one of them had been unhorsed, so that was Matt. But they, they've managed to, this was just a scouting party too that they ran into. This wasn't actually the main host.
No.
Lan is like, but look, they still, run!
They were basically all distracted. They were all in pain in some way, holding their heads. And so while they were in that state, they were all like, okay, let's get out of here. We've got an advantage. They've been subdued.
Now this is where we get to see another bout of really cool Aes Sedai magic. Because they run to the top of another hill, and Moraine pulls out the Angrial.
Before you head off into that direction, though,
go ahead.
They chop off the head, but then they say, there's a reference to the fact that apparently they don't die until nights fall. Even though their head's been chopped off, they're still alive.
Yeah.
It's a rumor, but
be interesting to see.
It'd be interesting to see whether or not it's true, or even if maybe they're able to heal themselves in some way.
That's just really getting disturbing.
That is going to get disturbing if it is the case, but still.
Headless Murderer walking around until it's 8 o'clock.
Can you imagine just comically holding his own head while still riding after them?
Okay, now you're pulling out.
I'm still going to get you.
Now you're pulling out Pirates of the Caribbean there.
No, not Pirates of the Headless. It's an American one. American story, and I can't be Ichabod Crane or whatever his name was. You know, the Headless Hunter. The one with the pumpkin head. Comically, the pumpkin head.
I prefer to think of the scene at the end of the second Pirates of the Caribbean movie.
Yeah, well, he runs off. It's a Halloween thing.
He's got
one
of the fish people there who's got...
But it's a Halloween thing. It's Ichabod Crane, isn't it? It's a Halloween thing, and they chop off... this black rider comes along and chops off all their heads. I can't remember.
It's not sounding familiar to me at all.
Oh. And I bet you all the people listening that are Americans all over that story and going, are you crazy? It's this. And I'm like, Oh, never mind.
Anyway, but here's where we get to see some really cool Aes Sedai magic. So they run to the top of of another hill. There's still the horns going around to...
They seem to recover quickly enough.
And
although there is still wailing.
I gotta admit, it is pretty dang awesome what she does. So she raises... Moraine raises both the staff and the Angreal, and I will. There's a conversation that's going to be coming up that I do want to talk about with this, but we'll get to that conversation in a minute. And causes not only an earthquake, but a wall of fire.
Well, either that or the fire is coming from underneath. Like she's always drawing the elements out of the
earth. Yeah.
So that's possibly why it was earthquakey, because she was drawing the fire element out of the earth.
Quite possibly, yeah. So far, abilities that we've, or magical spells or whatever that we've been able to see, Moraine...
Or her magical will.
Is that she can turn into a giant.
Or give the illusion that she's a giant.
Yeah. She's also able to cloak. To a point.
Mm-hmm.
And now she...
sink a boat.
Sink a boat, yeah. Kind of whirlpool thing that she was able to do. I'd say that if I was to pick the type of magic that she's pulling into, I'd say elemental. Largely.
Well, didn't she say it was elemental magic?
Well, we're getting more and more proof of that here. I don't know. I can't... It's because of how far into the book, and yay, we're over a third. Woohoo! Taking us a better part of a year to get there. Apologies on that, listeners, but we are being more regular, as you can see. But the fact that... can't remember whether it was actually clearly said there was that the one power was elemental in nature. But but based on the type of magic that she's been wielding, I'm not quite sure what element... Oh, air. Of course, for the illusion. Mm. And water for the whirlpool.
Or it could be...
Fire and earth are pretty self-explanatory for the earthquake, and the wall of fire is coming up now. So this is, I think, it's proven to... Elemental magic can be pretty dang powerful when used effectively, as Moraine clearly knows how to do.
It was not just that. It could be an element of you think it and will it, it can happen.
Of course. There's got to be... she's not just letting the one power do willingly whatever it wants.
No,
that's some sort of control.
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that if she can think it happen, if she can will it to happen,
I agree with you there, but the one thing that we don't know quite yet is how the one power is controlled.
Mm.
I know that there's, because we don't hear her chanting.
It does flow through her.
There's no chanting.
No, but it does flow through her.
It does. But it's got to be, and I agree that that it's a lot of mental, that it would take a lot of mental strain. And you can tell that after each of the times that she's had to use the One Power in the larger ways that that she's had to recently to protect this group, you're right, it does drain her. And she, because these events are happening so quickly, one after, you know, it's like a day at most between events, that she's had to use it. Lan correctly says that at some point you don't have the power to keep this up. Mm. It's draining you, and it's and whether or not if you lose, if it's just going to knock her unconscious or it's going to kill her because she's trying to do too much. We don't know what the effects of overuse of the One Power is physically.
Or if it just won't allow you to.
Or if it's just like a minor counter on the in a game where you got no more mana, you can't cast a spell. But I think that the mana.
I think it's in this element in that it will mana take it and from somewhere.
Well, mana and stamina, I think, are mixed in this case.
Maybe, or it could be like with Aragorn, where she's not using words, she's more using mental power. But it's more a case of, if you recall, with Aragorn, if he stated certainties in his spells that the elven words would do exactly what he said, and it won't stop until either he is dead or it's done
or the goal is achieved.
Yes. So, you know, when the twins were trying to trick him into turning the bowl, that was something, I think it was metal into gold or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't realize that doing that at that particular point in time, given the limited training he had at the time, would have killed him, because he didn't have the strength and he hadn't built up the mental capacity and the training and all the rest of it to do so. So I think in this instance it could be a similar thing, is that it will either do what she wants it to do until it's done, or it will kill her trying to do it.
Interesting to see. I mean, I agree with your logic, or I do understand your logic, and it's a fair argument. Because it's going to be interesting to see how that actually works, though.
Because I do like Christopher Pellini does make a point. Magic has to have a consequence or have a cost in some way. And any book series that doesn't have that, it kind of diminishes its effect, or its power and its effectiveness and its excitement about moments when it does get used and things like that. You know,
I agree.
It less impressive, I guess, as it were. And so
actually, that raises a question about the whole Harry Potter series now.
About how it doesn't really have, because it comes from the wand. The wand chooses the wizard, Mr. Potter.
Yeah, but there's no real cost to its usage.
No, that is true. There isn't. But it's more a case that was more of an entertaining story. So you kind of
didn't care about
that particular point, because the story was so fun and so exciting, and you can't, reading it to the kids, they were more excited about what happens to Fluffy or what happens to Hagrid, or you know, the moment when Hagrid falls out of the sky, they're like, no, Hagrid, and you know, kind of thing. So they were more excited about the story. I think the story was so effectively told, and so
but that point that didn't that need point, to be
it didn't need to be
fair point. Anyway, back to our thing. They're all stunned now at what's happened.
You've also got a base that the Harry Potter books are more strategically centered, or were meant more for the young teenager and child.
They're all stunned by what by what they've seen.
And the ball of fire.
Yeah, you know, they're all kind of, you know, even Rand, everyone putting hands in front of their faces because of the wall of heat that's just smacked them all. It cost Moraine a lot. She actually starts to almost falls off her horse, but Lan catches her and manages to get her back on. And they all continue to run. And after
well, they do, but at a slower they
call at a slower pace slower, because they need
slower pace.
Yeah, but they do.
But they do still need to keep it up. Yes,
because they the wall of heat is keeping the army at bay.
Mm.
But that's not going to last.
They're running as fast as their slowest member can go.
Yeah,
and right now that's Moraine in some ways because she's
trained. Weakened. Yes. Yeah. And as they're, I find this interesting though, because you've got a bit of a conversation here between, Lan and Moraine, where she says that I'm not at my strongest when working with earth and fire. So she has got, so it is elemental magic, but she would have a specialization in other elements, and she's had to tap into this as a kind of emergency last resort kind of thing to try and keep these people safe.
Or maybe it's harder for her to connect to it.
Maybe.
It could be.
But Nynaeve gives gives her some herbs, which Moraine accepts. No doubt to help regenerate her a little bit. And after a while, they get far enough away that they're able to take 5 minutes, and they have a bit of a conversation here about the and Egwene comes up to the boys, and asks them about the various chants that they had, and we get a bit of an explanation for them. First of all, the Manetherin was now the name of the people that they were descended from that fought the Dark One.
Well, hang on. They've also... They were riding and they wanted to find a place that was secluded.
That's what I'm saying. They managed to find a place to take 5 minutes.
Yeah, but you missed the whole description of it. And how impressive they were by it.
Okay.
The vines and things that were falling... That is clearly an old city.
We haven't gone to the city yet.
Oh, you're fine. Well, what are you talking about? They don't get the explanation, really.
Yeah, they do.
Oh, fine. Keep going.
Thank you. So we get, And then you've got the thing which Matt kind of called. And I'm just going to back up a couple of pages for that. Karai el Kaldazar, Karai en Elisande, el Elisande. And Moraine comes up to them at this point. And says that it gives a translation, for the honor of the Red Eagle, for the honor of the Rose and Sun, the Rose of the Sun. The ancient war cry of the Manetherin and the war cry of its last king, Eldarin, was called the Rose of the Sun. An interesting name. Personally, I think it's kind of a beautiful name.
Mm.
A name like that was telling me that that Eldarin would have been a good king. I think.
Yes. Or that he placed his people first, and that people sort of centered around him, I guess.
Mm. So they take a few moments just they don't take long, but they do just have just a few minutes to recover for a little bit, and then Tom is asking, do you intend for us to remain here for the rest of the day? And it's like, can't do it. Because, again, the horns go... or whatever. Again. To show that, they're on this side, they're on that side. We're still in a trap. They've managed to get past the fire.
They don't really...
Yeah, landslide. Yeah. Thank you, they've passed the fire.
No, I know that they've passed the fire, but it's more a case of that, they don't sort of really know that they're in a trap. It's more a case of they need to hide to ensure that they're in the city to ensure their safety.
Well, they've We're getting to that. We're almost there, dear. First thing that, the next thing
I
that...
I do like that the Maureen sort of smiles and says, you know, like the bloodline is still strong in the two rivers. The old blood still sinks. But it's still there.
Yeah.
And I think she's happy about that. She's definitely happy about that.
Yeah, no, I agree.
You know, that it's, you know, there was a point where she was worried that it had completely disappeared, and here she's got evidence that it's not completely gone.
So we've, and now, the next thing Maureen does, and I'm guessing this is air elemental magic that she's about to tap into, is to try and point their sense in a different direction so that, you know, the Trollocs will think that they've gone left when they've actually gone right, kind of thing.
She basically gets all of their sense, gets them excessively close, so that everyone's scent is in there and sends it in a westerly direction.
Yeah. Now here's a conversation that I wanted to kind of focus on a little bit, is where Egwene says that your staff is very powerful, and Maureen's like, I've told you, things don't have power. The one power comes from the true source, and only a living mind can wield it. This isn't even an Grail, merely something for me to focus on to help me think, to help me focus that magic. And I like that. The fact that it doesn't, that she, it could be a stone, it could be a book, it could be a piece of paper, it could be a wisp of grass. It just needs to be something to help her focus her thoughts. Mm. Because the object itself is a paperweight, essentially. And
much like the elf stones for
Shannara,
yes, thank you. I've forgotten his name. It wasn't the elf stones that had the power or held the power, or that, you know, he could, you know, and knowing that he was the only one that could wield it, the only reason why technically the stones glowed and he could wield it was because the magic for that was in his blood. It was his blood that was the key to his magic, and he realizes that he doesn't need it. In the end, he realizes that he doesn't need the stones because it was just a way for him to channel.
To focus.
And focus on what he was doing.
Yeah.
Or how to, you know, how to use it and stuff.
And so I've, but I do like that a lot, because there are times when you just need something to be able to focus on to help get your mind back on track to where it's supposed to be.
I'm curious about what the true source is, though. If you know whether that's a...
Well, the Earth.
Well, I suppose, maybe.
Given that it's elemental magic that they're wielding, and if the one... but I am a little curious if the one power is purely elemental.
Maybe. Or it could be a living spiritual being of some kind.
Going into the realm of godlike, well, going into the realm of pulling the magic from gods now, if you want to go there. But I think it's more, given what we've witnessed so far of the One Power, it seems to me to be very elemental in nature. Because even going right back to the beginning of the book with that family slaughter and the guy who turned himself into a mountain, earth magic.
Yeah, okay, except that they tainted their source of the One Power, the men's line. So that to me it's almost like that there's several doors in which you could access it, I guess, if you wanted to view it at that point, whereas the women access it through a particular door, the men access it through another particular door.
I like that, because if you're going down this... going with that for a minute, if the women access it through elemental, but the...
Well, how would the men access it then? It's still...
more chaotic.
That's only because that's only because their side's been tainted. Because someone opened it up to try and
to that chaotic, do something. Yeah, to that chaotic magic.
Oh, for crying out loud. Well... it wasn't that way to begin with.
No, it wasn't, until someone decided to try... Look, I need more magic, more power. I need to
gain... They tried to get the... more.
yeah, to get the kind of aggression, kind of power. I'm trying to say this badly, but I'm the chaotic, aggressive, combat type magic to which elemental is not generally used. Elemental is more...
Okay, so what you're saying is that they tainted it with aggression and anger, and so now it's aggressive and angry, and it's
that woken, side of it.
And that it's woken up in of itself and become the Dark One. Wow, that's a leap. It's... Okay.
Hey!
It's a point. It's a sign. It could have happened, more of a case, I suppose.
And the Dark One could have been waiting there for that kind of door to be open, and then... Sure, let me just walk on through so I can pray.
Or he could have been created by them by doing it. And that's where you're saying that there's a dark source that's now been, or the source has now been tainted. Except that then if they're all getting it from the one source, why isn't the entire lot broken? Then.
Tell me something. And I do have a really good analogy for you for that. When was the last time that you had soup?
It's been a while since I've had soup.
Okay, but generally speaking with soup, you got soup with vegetables and you got whatnot in it, right?
Darling.
Yeah?
They all get their magic from the same place.
The soup from the one cauldron.
Yes. They all get it from the same place.
The problem is the Aes Sedai have learned to pull out only the vegetables and to leave the core and to leave the actual liquid alone.
Oh, for crying out loud.
I'm just using that as a very simple example of how it could work.
It's a very bad one. It's a very bad one. There's no way it can happen.
It's an analogy that works.
No.
Very, very loosely.
That's just going off into the fairy twitty bird land.
But anyway, they wander through this forest and the lion tells them they've got to be quiet because while their scent has been sent in this direction,
their sound. Yeah.
Exactly. So still,
and even so, they're going slower and they're trying to cover their trail so that they cannot be followed.
Yeah.
And instead of going through brush and things like that, they go around it.
And there's no more horns.
Yeah.
Either. So they've got no idea how far away that the Trollocs and the army is.
Mm.
But they keep walking through quietly through this forest and they come across a really large wall. And the initial thing is a cliff, but then they realize that as they get a little closer, it's a tower. And a rather large tower. Which is kind of at the outskirts of a very large city that's, about, it had to be 10 times as big as Baylon. 50 times as big, so it's huge where this place is.
Which kind of makes me curious as to what on earth happened for this city to have been completely abandoned the way it was.
Yeah.
And they recognised that. They recognised that it was definitely abandoned because, of course, vines break down walls, which is why you got to keep them clear of walls.
And yeah, things. Yeah.
But it was a case of...
it's just very overgrown.
It was definitely very overgrown. It makes me wonder why the heck it was abandoned to begin with. There's got to have been a definite story behind this. It could be that maybe you know how it lands part of the seven broken towers. The house she saw in the pattern, seven broken towers, and how he is connected to that. I'm kind of curious as to whether or not...
It's potentially linked
to him, maybe. Linked to him.
Maybe.
This is one of the towers that's fallen and they're broken. That he's the last. Because she said before he goes scouting, she does say farewell, last of the law, or the last lord.
Last of the seven lords or something like that, yeah.
So there were obviously seven lords to these towers and he was one of them. And the rest of them are all gone. And he's either abandoned his, or something happened to his city for him to abandon it altogether.
So we get the name of the city, Originally, it was called Aridol. And after Aridol died, it was known by another name. And Lan then says, look, we're going to go in through here. And we get the name of Shada Logoth. Now, what I'm picturing when I hear the name Shada Logoth is essentially Minas Morgul. When it comes to the Lord of the Rings series. Because the story with Minas Morgul is that originally it was a bastion of, or one of the outposts of Gondor. It was a good city until it got corrupted. And I'm thinking that something similar happened here. And that Aridol somehow got corrupted to be a Dark One outpost, for lack of a better way to phrase it. And
they wouldn't fear to go into it.
Well, something must have happened there to cause the Dark Ones... to cause the Dark One to flee. Or to cause... there's got to have been some kind of event that happened in that city that made it... I don't know, kind of like...
livable for both sides.
What's the word? Radioactive.
I suppose, but there's not much that would scare.
Well, I'm just saying that there's the fact that it's freaking out both sides. There's got to be something that's made that place, for lack of a better word, radioactive. Because you go into a radioactive place, you drop a bomb, a nuclear bomb. No one's going to want to be in that radioactive place for quite some time. Same kind of deal. Here, and I'm wondering what the heck was that nuclear event that has created all this radiation, so to speak.
It could be the Dragon's Mountain, as it were, that was created, but there's no mountain nearby that to work.
No. So we'll find that out. I'm hoping we'll find that in the next chapter. I mean, the next chapter is entitled Shadows Waiting. So... interesting title. And given the way... I'm guessing that somehow, given the size of the city, that A, they are going to be able to find some place to hide. That's going to be the first thing that they need to do. And then they need to find some way to be able to not only hide, but escape. My guess is out the other side or out through another exit somewhere while...
or potentially through tunnels, underground tunnels or something like that.
Possibly, yeah.
Because you would imagine that something of that scale would have...
a sewer system or catacombs or something.
Yeah, an underground escape sort of system where they could hide. Hence the whole shadows waiting because they're...
underground? Going shadows?
Yeah.
Yeah, makes sense. Because they still need to be able to continue on their journey to try to get to Tar Valon. But they need to lose their pursuers. And a place this big is a classic way or a classic place to do something like that.
Yeah. But it is abandoned too, so... and I suppose that's...
not to mention the fact that bad guys scared of it. Means that they wouldn't necessarily want to go in there too willingly. But
they've got a reason to be scared about it.
Whatever that reason is, though, I want to find out. So, on that note, we do want to thank our dear listeners for enjoying listening to another episode. If you do want to contact us, questions, comments, constructive feedback, you're welcome to do so by emailing me at my email address, warrior346@yahoo.com. on my Twitter feed at Warrior346, or you can also leave some feedback on the Apple Store on the Apple Podcast Store. So thanks again for listening. We're probably going to go away and listen to another chapter now, I imagine, given where this one has ended up, much to our annoyance. And so thank you all, and may the Wheel of Time keep on spinning.